Okay, everyone. So let's answer some more questions and so we'll see what happens this evening. So, okay, good. All right, dear Arjan, can you elaborate on how neutral feeling is more superior than pleasant, unpleasant feeling? I read from somewhere, probably Bhikkhu Anālayo's writings, that neutral feeling may stimulate ignorance when one is unaware of the arising and disappearance of neutral feeling. So neutral feeling in kind of daily, ordinary life is often accompanied by ignorance, because you're not really aware of what is going on. You're not really able to see that ordinary neutral feeling as positive, because it doesn't really have any attraction in ordinary life. And so it is kind of, this is what is the idea of the underlying ignorance, the inability to see it as positive. And that is why very often what you have to do is you have to go through all of the various stages of samadhi, all the way to the profound jhana states. And only then is it possible to understand why this is superior. So when neutral feeling is accompanied by incredibly profound peace, the mind is very unified, and all of the other qualities are very positive, that is when it becomes obvious that neutral feeling is very powerful and very very attractive. But really only in that kind of situation is it possible to see that, because of all the other good qualities that come with it. And that's when the understanding arises of the power of neutral feelings. Whereas the ordinary neutral feelings that you have in ordinary life, when you are quite kind of equanimous and not really drawn one way or the other, is kind of just boring, kind of uninteresting. And that's why they say it is accompanied by ignorance, by lack of understanding. So you need to develop through the whole process, and that's when you kind of can get what is going on. So I hope that makes a little bit of sense. Let's go on to the next one. I thought I just hit a nimitta and then realized someone just turned on the light. Okay. Yeah, that's not exactly the same thing. So, okay. Because of our defilements, we don't see clearly and don't have right view, but we also need a right view to help us get rid of our defilements. It just seems like an impossible task sometimes. So it kind of builds on each other, right? So you have some idea what is going on, you have some idea what defilements are, you have some idea right view. And so then as you build on these things, as you start to reduce your defilements, a bit more right view arises, and because you have a bit more right view, it enables you to eliminate a bit more defilements, and it kind of goes on and on like that. It's kind of a gradual process. So it is not impossible. The Buddha said it is possible. You just have to keep going and kind of gradually undoing the problem. Eventually you get there. So it may sound like a catch-22, but actually it's not really the case. You just have to kind of go slowly and see what happens. All right. Dear Arjan, it is interesting to learn from Venerable Tissa Metteya's question and answers that the senior monks, even at the time of the Buddha, had different interpretation of the Buddha's words. What chance of the later additions to the suttas being any more accurate? Thank you and others for focusing on the originality of the suttas. It's true that you have the later additions to the suttas, like the commentaries or whatever, or extra things that came afterwards. It doesn't mean that what is in the suttas necessarily is wrong. I mean, these are the six different interpretations, and different interpretations can all be accurate at the same time. It doesn't mean that these monks are wrong, right? It's just different angles on the same problem. But sometimes when you have later suttas, later understanding, it can be literally wrong. And it is when it's wrong that it is a problem. So they need to distinguish between interpretations that are right and interpretations that are wrong. And sometimes it is possible to have many different interpretations that are all right, even more interpretations that are wrong, right? You have a few right ones and you have many, many more wrong ones. So this is kind of the problem. The way to gradually kind of find your way through the suttas is, of course, to read many suttas, and they kind of tend to reinforce each other, and they help you to interpret. And the more you understand, the easier it is to interpret, because you see how it all fits together. And then, of course, you have your own understanding from your own meditation as well, that gradually builds up. And together, it gives you some pretty powerful tools to understand things. And then you have teachers that you trust, someone like Ajahn Brahm or whatever it might be, who also, inspires confidence. And then when you hear what he has to say, it tends to just add to all the other ways of knowing what's going on. So it's not impossible. You just have to kind of be patient and then carry on. And then as you do this, things kind of tend to become clear over time. All right. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you for sharing all these wonderful teachings of the Buddha. Please, can you share some insight into how we can let go of things during our meditation practice, especially the things we aren't even aware we are carrying around? Thank you. Okay, so yes, this is a problem. Sometimes you can feel that you are hitting a hurdle in your meditation. It kind of stops. It's like you reach a kind of plateau or something. And it's obvious that something is blocking you from going deeper. And the answer is quite simple. The Buddha really gives the answers to what the problem is. And the problem is always that you are basically holding onto something in the realm of the five senses. That is the problem. Something in that realm that is kind of blocking you. And then you just need to figure out what it is. There are some simple ways of overcoming it. One of the reasons that why we do metta meditation and why we have compassion in Buddhism is precisely because that helps us not only to overcome anger and ill will, but it's actually also helpful for the five sense realm, because you have an alternative source of happiness. And when you have an alternative source of happiness and contentment and satisfaction and all of that, then the five sense realm is less interesting, it's easier to let go. So doing a little bit of compassion and metta. It was interesting when we had that fellow here this afternoon. It's very hard not to have a sense of compassion because it's so obvious that there's so much suffering going on the surface. Just seeing a person like that kind of brings out compassion. That is, of course, if you're coming from a Dhamma point of view. If you're coming from a worldly point of view, you might get upset by it. But from a Dhamma point of view, it's kind of easy to see. And you just all you need to do is to kind of direct your mind in that direction. And then it leads to something positive rather than to being a negative experience. And this is what you try to do also during your meditation, to bring up those positive things. And that already will be very helpful for you. So one of the things that you see in the Satipatthana Sutta, and one of the basic practices there is kind of to understand the body, to let go of the body a little bit. And one way of doing that is to have the four element contemplation, right? To see the body as equivalent to the world outside, the earth, water, fire, air kind of elements. And seeing the body as no different. Take away some of the interest in the physical body. And that reduces basically the interest in the entire five sense world, because it becomes less interesting. So a little bit of overcoming of attachments, a little bit of finding the happiness in the here and now. And then the two together will kind of tend to develop the mind in the right direction. It helps you to let go in this way. But it's very gradual, right? It takes time. You have to do these things gradually. And then as it gradually develops, these things start to happen as a consequence. Letting go and then developing an alternative happiness. These are the kind of two pillars. Letting go leads to peace. Developing an alternative happiness means that it's easier to let go because you have something else. Okay, so good evening to you, Ajahn Brahmali. Good evening. And the monks and nuns here, not so many monks, but some nuns are still here. So that's good. Earlier you said the idea of watching pain doesn't work. How then should one whose body is already afflicted with chronic illness practice? The pain of the body may never go away. Yeah. So if you have chronic illness, then of course you don't have much choice. Yeah, the illness is going to be there, and it's going to be something that you have to deal with. But what I meant was more like people who deliberately don't move, and they sit in the same posture, even though they have a lot of pain. That's what I was referring to. People who almost are producing pain, almost when it actually isn't really necessary. That is what I was referring to. Of course, if you are in the unfortunate situation of having chronic pain, then you are going to have to somehow work through that pain. Still, you want to minimize it. You don't want to make it worse than it actually is, yeah, by multiplying that pain. So you want to find a kind of posture whereby you can be at ease as much as possible. And then you have to try to go beyond that pain, yeah, to use the meditation or whatever to try to leave the pain behind, whether it's watching the breath or doing metta or whatever it is, to allow the pain gradually, hopefully, to disappear. So in your situation, of course, there is not much choice. Then you have to find the best way of dealing with that. Sometimes the best way of dealing with can be, as you maybe are indicating here, to actually watch that pain and to sort of be aware of it, to somehow penetrate it and to see it as insubstantial by watching it. When you watch things directly for a period of time, you often find that it is always moving, always changing, doesn't really have any essence to it. And as you do that, it can make it easy to let go because you see the, you know, how it actually is something that it's just this kind of thing which kind of is never really, it's not really solid in a sense. And then it kind of can dissipate through that kind of observation. So you just have to do your very best to deal with that. That sometimes that is the unfortunate reality. A lot of people seem to have chronic pains these days. Somehow you have to kind of find your way of dealing with that. All right. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, that's good. Delightful and joyful to listen to the Dhamma teachings inspiring us, Ajahn of the Right View. My heartfelt gratitude for your excellent explanations and kind considerations to include the requested suttas. A very warm thank you to Ajahn, Lehar, Christina, Nolia, and good Dhamma friends gathered to rejoice in the Dhamma. Much metta. Okay, that's wonderful. Usually these notes come at the end of the retreat, but now we get them in the middle of the retreat as well, which is kind of nice. Actually, it's better to have it now, isn't it? Because now we can rejoice in it and we can kind of get some happiness out of this. So actually, we should actually have these thank you notes in the middle of the retreat rather than at the end. That's what I reckon, because now it is kind of more useful. Or maybe both, at the maybe beginning, middle, and end, maybe even better. Let's see. Anyway, so let's carry on. Dear Ajahn, in the middle sutta discussed today, can we consider that sticking in the middle is caused by desire and craving? Absolutely. So that's usually how you stick in the middle. It may be that all three are natural phenomena in a developed mind. Others hold on to what has been arisen and may be delaying the passing away. Yes, absolutely. And that is precisely the problem. You hold on to what is arisen. So you have the present moment. You are in the present, but you're grasping the present. Or you have the feelings and you're grasping the feelings. Sometimes it's a bit strange, though, because some of the middle that was mentioned was the cessation. And when cessation is the middle, it's not so obvious what it means to stick to the middle. And that was kind of the one of the issues that I touched on very briefly and not entirely sure how to interpret that. But I agree with what you're saying. Yeah, so that's good. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, what are the four jhanas and how do I reach them? What do I have to do to reach the first one? Step-by-step instructions would be gratefully appreciated. Thank you. So the step-by-step instructions is just to relax, enjoy, and bang, go into the first jhana. That's kind of the instruction. Very simple. It's one of those things that really fascinated me about Ajahn Brahm, because Ajahn Brahm, the way he taught meditation in the early days when I came to Bodhidharma Monastery, I would go to him and say, oh, you know, what should I do? My meditation is kind of not really, you know, not really going where I would like it to go. And he just said, sit longer. That was his advice, sit longer. And I would say, I come back after a while, I'm sitting longer, what should I do now? Sit longer. This was the one advice. And then over the years, he kind of refined that advice, and he didn't say just sit longer, but he said, don't do anything. So the two advice, sit longer and then don't do anything. That was kind of his advice. Just relax, just be with whatever, and things will develop. And this is the way Ajahn Brahm meditates. And this is kind of, it's really cool. And it's really sort of, basically, just really exactly how what you find in the suttas. And for Ajahn Brahm, it's just a matter of sitting down, closing your eyes, and relaxing. And then when he relaxes, the joy comes, the happiness comes, the nimitta comes, and bang, everything happens as a consequence. So that is really the path. The path is just to relax. The path is just to learn, to let go, to be with things, rather than to try to do the meditation. Too much doing in meditation, not enough just being. And if you can just be, then the meditation unfolds all by itself. And this is kind of the thing, right? This is kind of what is so interesting about this. In reality, there are going to be obstacles, and then you have to deal with the obstacles. And this is what kind of is the path really is about. You have to know your obstacles. You have to know the things that block you. And one way of doing that is just to watch your mind, to see the content of your mind. What are the things that you occur in your mind as you try to be peaceful? And those things that occur, they give an indication of what your problems are. And sometimes there may be people who you find irritating and difficult. Maybe you get a bit upset. Okay, that is why you need to do some compassion and have some kindness. Because these people are upsetting you. That becomes one of the obvious things that you have to do. The other thing that you have to do is you have to see that your mind thinks about all kinds of worldly things. So you have to let go of the world a little bit more. Find less interest in the world. Guide your mind towards the kind of higher aspects of life, or whatever you want to call it. This is the thing about right view again. Right view guides the mind in the right direction. And that is what it really is all about. So you learn just to be quiet. You sit down. When mindfulness arises, then the breath is there, and then you're doing breath meditation. And all you really need to do is stay with the breath. And if you stay with the breath, then all of these things happen, one after the other. This is what the path is about. It's very simple. It's very sort of basic, and the reason why it seems hard is not because it is difficult, it's just that there are hindrances in the mind that somehow we need to overcome. So the path is actually very straightforward. If you want to find out more about the step-by-step instruction to achieving these kind of deep states of meditation, one of the suttas to listen to is the Anapanasati Sutta, the Sutta on Mindfulness of Breathing. It takes you through all the stages, all the steps, in fact, all the way to awakening, all the way to the very end of the path, just by following the breath. So this is what you have to do. So you are with the breath. As you stay with the breath, you don't do anything, you start to become peaceful. As you start to become peaceful, the more peaceful you are, the more calm the breath is, the joy starts to rise. The joy arises because the peace is so delicious. Or maybe you incline your mind a little bit towards something joyful. And when the joy arises, you stay with the joy, you stay with the breath, they're there at the same time. That too becomes more peaceful. The joy becomes more powerful. And as the joy and the peace become more powerful, there comes a point when these things we call nimittas arise. Nimittas are like bright lights in the mind. And the very beautiful, powerful, bright lights in the mind. You stay with those nimittas. They become brighter, even more peaceful. And you take that all the way into a jhana state. A jhana is a state of deep meditation when the whole world is unified into one thing. It is just pure bliss. And nothing else is happening except for pure bliss. This is what the jhana states are like. And then you go down the jhana states, deeper and deeper jhanas, until it gets more and more refined, more and more powerful bliss, until eventually all that is left is equanimity. Equanimity is one of the highest happinesses you can have. So that's a rough idea of how this path works. But it starts out with just sitting down, doing nothing, enjoying what is going on, learning to undo this habit that we have of always doing everything in life. We are doing this as kind of the anti-doing. That's what meditation is about. So please do some anti-doing, or undo the anti-doing, or whatever it is, whatever the right instructions are. So something like that, and just keep on listening to the what we're doing here, and gradually you will get the idea. We'll actually look a little bit more at mindfulness of breathing towards the very end of the retreat. Okay, why does Buddhism have glitzy and golden statues of the Buddha? It seems contradictory to simplicity and renunciation. Are you talking about this one over here? So that is a very good question. So why is it? So maybe we should chuck it out. What do you reckon? Is that a good idea? Maybe we should get rid of it? I don't know. I think I tend to agree a little bit with you that golden and glitzy statues of the Buddha is not really what Buddhism is about. But remember, we have a long history of Buddhism in the world. And that long history, people want to honor the Buddha, they want to honor the Dhamma. And this is often how it is done. Yeah, it is done because people have faith and confidence and these kind of things. And then they want to, and they do it in this way. And I agree with you, it's probably not the best way to doing things. But this is what we have inherited as part of the Buddhist tradition. And sometimes you kind of go with the inheritance, and sometimes you oppose it, and sometimes it's kind of a bit random how these things work. And sometimes people bring, like this Buddha statue over here was given by the World Fellowship of Buddhists, one of the largest Buddhist organizations in the world. It was given to the Buddha Society because of our kind of prominence in the world or whatever. So what do you do when something like a beautiful gift is given to you? Do you reject it and say, what golden Buddha statues? We don't accept golden Buddha statues. Or do you accept it, you know, in a way, okay, thank you, that's very kind of you. And then you kind of go with the flow. These things are very, you know, it's all about kind of getting things right, and it's kind of can be very tricky here. But in principle, I agree with you. In reality, it is complex, and you have to kind of find compromise a little bit and find the right way with these things. Interestingly, that in the very early days after the Buddha passed away, there were no Buddha images at all. There were no Buddha statues. That is a much later invention. In the early days, there was just a memory of the teachings, and they practiced accordingly. And then there were some other symbols in the early days that were used sometimes, like the lotus flower was a symbol of the Buddha or of Buddhism, and these things were used instead. Then after a certain time, they started to make statues of the Buddha, and there is some evidence that that was influenced by the Greek, because the Greek ideas were very much about making statues, and the Greeks came all the way to India, and so there was a cultural exchange there between Indian culture and the Greek culture, and that may have been the start of creating statues. So it's actually the European fault, yeah? We are at fault. Those with a European background, it's our fault that we have these statues in the first place. That's another way of thinking about it. Whose fault is it anyway? It's just random, right? It's no one's fault and everyone's fault. So that gives you some idea how these things are. All right, let's carry on. Okay, so this is, are underlying tendencies kamma resultants? Thank you. Are underlying tendencies, anusayas, are they kamma resultants? Not really. Underlying tendencies are always there, right? And they are kamma resultants. The only thing that results from kamma is really how you feel the world. So if you make a lot of bad karma, you get reborn in a bad destination, and you have a lot of pain and suffering as a consequence. So bad karma leads to suffering. good karma leads to happiness and pleasure. And that is really the connection with karma. It's the connection between intention and how you feel the world. But underlying tendencies has nothing to do with how you feel the world. Underlying tendencies have to do with the defilements of the mind, the problems in the mind, and how they are kind of carried on, from they're kind of always there unless you eliminate them. So they kind of just carry on in this way. Karma resultance is always about whether we experience the world as pleasurable or not. Underlying tendencies are more like habits, and they are, it's not exactly the same as karma. All right. Hi Ajahn, there are some suttas I find hard to relate to, in particular the more analytical ones pertaining to the aggregates, the six sense fields, dependent origination, etc. I imagine the Buddha and his disciple delivered teachings to a wide range of individuals with varying degree of spiritual faculties, from the worldliest worldling to the noblest of nobles. Because of this, when I usually encounter a sutta that seems out of my depth, besides a preliminary conceptual understanding, I don't spend too much time dwelling on it. Do you think this is a skillful attitude when exploring the suttas? Mega thanks for your teachings. Yes, I think that often is perfectly okay. You don't have to dwell a lot on conceptual things, especially if you don't enjoy it. What matters is really to have enough sense of confidence and faith in the teachings that you can do the practice. As long as you feel that you're able to do the practice in a good way and you have the confidence in the teachings, then just carry on. Sometimes it will be the time to investigate the suttas in a bit more depth, because suddenly the question starts to arise in your mind. How does this work? What is going on here? What does rupa mean anyway? What actually is vedana? What are these five khandhas, these five aggregates that we talk about? How do you experience these things? Because we need to relate these conceptual categories, as you call them, we need to relate that to our actual experience. And when you relate them to your experience, then these things really come alive as a consequence. So don't worry too much, but often there comes a time when these things do become interesting, precisely because they start to relate to how you live your life and how you think about the Dhamma and all of these kind of things. So I agree with you. Don't worry too much, and then when the time is right, then you will naturally take an interest in these things. Okay, what is with the teddy bears? Please explain the teddy bears. Don't you like teddy bears? So the teddy bears are the teachers. Yeah. This is the real teacher. Like the teddy bear is kind of cute. Teddy bear is soft, very soft. And teddy bear is kind of, you can hug the teddy bear like this, so you kind of feel, and when you hug a teddy bear, it's like, it feels kind of, you feel soft, right? You feel kind of more gentle when you hug the teddy bear. So if you feel that you are on a retreat and you're feeling that your things are a bit rough and things are a bit hard, or you're not really soft enough or gentle enough, then you take the teddy bear and you hug a teddy bear. And you go like this. Ajahn Brahm has, there's a nice picture of Ajahn Brahm when he hugs the teddy bear like this. So this is the idea, because the meditation works when you are gentle and soft inside, not when you are kind of hard-hearted or you are trying too much and all of these kind of things. That actually destroys your ability to meditate. So the idea of the teddy bear is to bring a softness and gentleness to the occasion. So if you want to hug a bear, teddy bear, in your meditation, please do so. It's okay. You can grab one of the bears over here and you can take it with you, take it back to your room, sleep with a teddy bear at night. This will be really, this is perfectly okay. But the idea is to soften up a little bit, because it is that softness of the mind that actually enables the meditation to work. So that is kind of what is with the teddy bear. So if you are too shy to grab the teddy bear, let me know and I'll bring you a teddy bear. All right, let's go on to the next one. What is the rationale for the fasting and eating times for monastics and retreatants? Surely these times vary with the seasons, as the time between dawn and the sun reaching its zenith is variable. The rationale is to keep life as simple as possible. Yeah, so as a monastic, normally you would have one meal a day, perhaps two, perhaps a breakfast and a main meal, often just one meal a day. And it's to keep things simple. The idea of monasticism is to focus on meditation and the spiritual things and not on eating, and not on kind of indulging in eating. And when you have one meal a day or two meals a day, it kind of, you forget about food for the rest of the time, and you can focus on meditation instead. And it works surprisingly well. One meal a day is often plenty. It's not difficult to live on one meal a day. And you kind of forget about food after a while. It's not really important to you anymore. And it works really well. So the idea is to move the mind towards the development of the mind and away from the sensual experience of things. And you'll be surprised how actually it's not really an issue. It's sometimes it's difficult to understand from an ordinary lay perspective, because we're used to having three meals a day or four meals a day or I don't know how many meals a day. Once you kind of get into a different habit, it's not very difficult to see how this works. And it's very simple. You don't have to worry about it. And as a monastic, because you rely on the generosity of others, it makes sense again to keep it very, very simple. And this is the idea. Yes, it is true that the dawn and the zenith, of course, it is variable. But the variations are not that great. They're fairly small. Unless you live in Norway, where I come from, then it can get really tricky, because the north of Norway is above the polar circle, right? So you have 3 months a year, it's black all the time. And it's very hard to kind of decide when dawn is, when it's kind of pitch black all the time. Basically means you can't eat for 3 months. That's what it means. And that is a little bit too much, right? You get very thin after 3 months, so that's kind of not recommended. But then you have to find another way of dealing with those things. But generally speaking, it's an easy way of doing things. Remember, time of the Buddha, you had to have some kind of regulations that works for everyone. And it's an easy way of knowing, because you can just go out, you look up into the sky, and you can know whether it's dawn or not. And the zenith of the sun can also be kind of measured relatively easily. So that's why we're using these natural ways of deciding these things. Dear Ajahn, I notice that most monastery has a small statue of Sivali, but Venerable Sivali is seldom mentioned during retreats. Can you briefly talk about him? So Venerable Sivali is the reason why I don't talk much about him, is because he doesn't really occur in the suttas. Venerable Sivali is mostly a commentarial kind of person. I'm not sure whether he really existed at the time of the Buddha. Maybe he did, or maybe shortly afterwards. But Venerable Sivali was one of these monks, apparently, who received lots of gifts all the time. He always had lots of food coming his way, so he may have done some very good karma in the past, and now he's kind of the recipient of large amounts of food and all kinds of things. And that's really what he was famous for, being the recipient of lots of things. It's a bit strange to be famous for that, isn't it? But that's what it was like. Not for his meditation, not for being virtuous, but for being the recipient of lots of things. But the idea, of course, is that it is to inspire people to be generous, because it is the result of generosity. It's the result of a life well lived. And that's why he was the recipient of so many things. So that's really all. But because it is mostly commentarial and not from the suttas, I don't pay all that much attention to it. The commentaries tend to focus on the Dhamma in slightly different ways. Often lose track of kind of the really essential and core things. And I think this is one example of that. When someone is famous for what they receive rather than for how they practice, it's a little bit unusual and not really, to my mind, not really so inspiring. If someone knows more about Sivali, Venerable Sivali, than I do, you are very welcome to add to this at some point if you like. Dear Ajahn, recently I've been hearing of a few friends who are struggling with mental health. Some medication causes hallucination, which makes it even more challenging for them to discern what is reality and perception. Why are some people more prone to depression? Could this be due to past lives and karma? What teachings are suitable for these vulnerable friends when they may not have the right mental faculties and time to understand and practice the Dhamma like the rest of us? And the reason, as you say, why people are more prone to depression can very well be because of past karma. It can also be because of bad habits, habits of using our minds in ways that are not very useful. Why do people get depressed? Well, they get depressed if you feel that the world is kind of, you know, going the wrong way, and there's no hope, and there is no future in the world, and all of these kind of things. This is one way people get depressed. And that's why they say there's a lot of depression in the world right now, because there are so many problems apparently in the world, with all kind of things going on. And the answer to that is simply that your future is not determined by what happens in the world. Your future is determined by how you live. If you live well, you're going to have a bright future. That's such a beautiful thing, because it means that even in the middle of climate change, in the middle of wars, in the middle of all these issues going on, still you have a bright future if you live well. It's such a hopeful message. And of course, your ability to live well is entirely up to you. It doesn't really depend on the world outside, or it doesn't depend so much on the world outside. And so that is kind of the beautiful message of the Dhamma. And this is helpful, it is also a message you can use for your friends who are prone to depression and sadness and these kind of things. And the other reason why people get depressed is because they feel they are useless, or they are not able to practice well or live well. They feel trapped maybe in a certain way, or they feel unable to develop themselves or whatever. Either the world is bad, or they are not happy with themselves. And again, the way to overcome that is to actually understand that you are able to do something with your life. You have that ability. You are empowered to change things as long as you kind of sustain the practice, you do the right thing. Over time, you will change. You will be able to get yourself out of a rut and out of bad habits. And then you start to feel better about yourself, because you feel that there is a way forward, there is a way out. You're not stuck forever in these negative traits you have, and whatever it might be. So these are really the two ways. As you start to develop the path and you start to feel that it works, and you're feeling good about yourself, you feel a sense of self-worth and self-value and these kind of things, start to come together. You are much better off as a consequence. So that is what I would recommend. It is not all that useful to think that it is because of past karma. If you think that depression is because of past karma, you might give up, because you might think, I'm stuck with this because of past karma. Much better to think that there is a way out, because there always is a way out. Even if it is because of past karma, there is a way forward. Because the past karma does not determine your future. It only affects you to some extent, but it's not determines what you're happening. So you eventually you come out of these things. All right. So there you are. Dear Ajahn, I feel so blessed to be here in Perth, to be able to listen to your teachings here in Jhana Grove. May I please ask for your suggestions on any Chinese, Cantonese translation of the suttas, so that my parents who can't read English can also benefit from these teachings. Thank you. Chinese translations, I think if you go to suttacentral.net, which is the main the main internet platform where the suttas are found, you find translations into all kinds of languages, including into Chinese. Some of Ajahn Brahm's books are translated into Chinese. I'm not sure if it is traditional Chinese characters or the newer Chinese, but anyway, it is there in Chinese, simplified or traditional, but it is available. Many of these things are actually available in Chinese characters. So check out suttacentral.net. See if you can find some of Ajahn Brahm's books translated into Chinese characters. That's also can also be very inspiring. I know also that some of the talks on the BSWA, they are dubbed into various kinds of languages. There is a whole team of people giving subtitles and things to the... I think subtitles, like not dubbing, subtitles to these talks. Yeah, and you can find that also on the BSWA website. And you can find with Chinese subtitles the talks, especially by Ajahn Brahm, they will be available there. And that's kind of nice. You can hear Ajahn Brahm in the background, yeah, kind of hear him laughing and telling it. And if you hear him kind of the, you know, calm and beautiful voice, and then you can kind of follow along by reading the Chinese characters underneath. Okay, there you are. Dear Ajahn, how should I approach a lazy 6-year-old son? He is kind, generous, and honest, but cares about nothing, including his homework. As long as he continues lay life, unfortunately, the sensual world is achievement-oriented. What are the right views and actions to this? Many thanks for your inspiring teachings. 6-year-old son is very, very young, right? So I have no idea what you to do with a 6-year-old son. If he is kind and generous and honest, that's kind of that's already quite good, and maybe you should just be happy with that. That he's a good person. Remember that what matters in the long run for your happiness is actually your the qualities of your personality, rather than actually whether you do your homework or not. Homework is kind of goes way down the list for what actually really matters in life. 6 years old, I wouldn't worry too much, to be honest. I would just see what happens. I would just... the most important thing that you can give your child is your love and compassion and understanding. If you can give that to your child, you're creating a secure individual. And when you create a secure individual, you are making someone who will be able to function really well in the world. That is the most important thing you can give to a child. Yeah, that sense of security, the sense of self-worth, the sense of being loved in the world. One of the most worst things is to grow up in a family where you don't feel loved by your parents and your family, because it makes you feel very insecure. And you will be always seeking the love and the understanding of other people around you. And that is always going to be problematic. But someone who is secure in themselves, they're going to be able to navigate the world really well. This is the most important thing that the parent can give a child. And when a child feels secure, that child will be able to make good choices because it will trust its own judgment, it will know the difference between good and bad, and it will make good choices in the world. Whether they do the homework or not is kind of not all that important. Allow that to develop in its own right. One of the biggest problems in life is that we identify ourselves through our children. Our identity is often, or our sense of self-worth is to some extent given by how our children are. Yeah. So for example, if you have a child and the child misbehaves in front of people you want to impress, you feel embarrassed, right? But it is your sense of self that is kind of, your sense of self is affected by your child. And that is the wrong way of thinking. That is, we shouldn't kind of have that kind of identity whereby our child's behavior is an extension of how we feel about ourselves. And everyone wants to be proud of their children. Yeah, my son or daughter is doing really, really well at school, right? That's kind of how we want things. But actually, it is a really slightly selfish kind of concern. I want to feel good through the way that my child behaves. And this is really problematic. Yeah, it should be completely irrelevant. What you should be concerned about is your child's happiness, not whether you can be proud of your child. Yeah, forget about that pride in your child. Your child is a separate human being, and your job is to give the child the best possible means to be happy in this life. Give it love, give it compassion, give it understanding, regardless of how that child behaves or what it does. And then I think you're giving that child the best possible means of having a good life rather than a successful life in worldly terms, which is not so important. Anyway, that's my take on that. So, all right. Dear Ajahn, you discuss the dangers of the five senses. Please also discuss the danger of the thinking mind, the sixth sense. Yes? Is there a sutta that explains this? I ask because in our contemporary society, the thinking, intellectual, categorizing, planning is so highly praised. Don't we also need this thinking mind to discern yucky thoughts turn good thoughts? Is a dullard easier to achieve samadhi than the intellectual? A dullard is not ideal, because dullard means your mind is dull, it is not clear. You want to have a sharp mind, that is very important. But a sharp mind is not the same thing as a thinking mind. A sharp mind just means a mind that is clear, that has the ability to discern. And that is different. So again, the thinking mind, what you have to do is you have to look at what kind of thoughts you have. And the point I've been trying to make before is that most of the thinking is actually about the five senses. It's about that realm. Yeah. So the way to overcome the thinking mind is very much often the same thing as the way to overcome the interest in the five senses. These things are not different. You actually overcome that problem by understanding the five senses in the right way. The vast majority of thinking is about in that realm. Also, it is often about maybe having some ill will and some negativity and these things, but that also ultimately comes down to the five senses. And there's very little thinking left if you take that whole realm out. And it actually becomes quite easy to calm the mind down if you are able to let go of the five sense realm. So I think that really is the answer to that one. Yes, sometimes you do need to plan a little bit, and sometimes that is important. But if you're going to plan, then set aside time for planning, and you plan then, and you don't plan at other times. You don't plan during your meditation, etc., because that actually is not really planning at all. It's just the mind kind of, you know, doing its thing without really any structure or any clear direction to what you're doing here. All right. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your amazing wisdom and sharing it with us. With Australia widely adopting the laws of voluntary assisted dying, what are the implications of a Buddhist to request euthanasia? How might this impact the karmic journey? When it comes to karma and life, remember it is always about, karma ultimately is about what motivates us. So you have to ask, if you are going to ask for assisted dying, you have to ask yourself, why are you asking for that? And if you're asking because of some bad reason, then of course it's going to be bad karma, because that is how karma works. But if you're asking for it maybe for a good reason, maybe out of compassion and wisdom, then it is no problem from a Buddhist point of view. But of course you have to be careful. You have to really know your intentions well. You have to understand your mind very, very clearly. And that is really what it comes down to. So in Buddhism, when we talk about precepts like not killing and not stealing, etc., these are just approximations to ethics. They are not the final say in ethics. The final say in Buddhist ethics is what drives your actions, what motivates you. That is the final say. So that is what you have to ask. So In our society, if we have laws that voluntary assisted dying is acceptable or accepted, legally accepted, then we should have some safeguards to help people make good choices. Why do you want to die? Oh, I just feel so terrible, I'm so sad, I just want to die. That may not be a good time to die, right? Instead, try to build up some positive things. But if you think, oh, my life has become meaningless because I have this terrible chronic pain and I can't really do anything useful anymore, and it is just a matter of compassion for myself that I want to die, it doesn't seem to have any point in living any longer, then maybe it is okay, because maybe you will die a few weeks or a few months down the track anyway. So you have to very carefully look at what is going on and then make the right decisions. And I think, as a matter of principle, my position is that, are we really allowed to tell other people that you have to live if you don't want to live? Do we have that right? You must live. I'm going to force you to live whether you want to or not. Is that compassion or is that harshness? You can see how forcing someone to live can also be harsh. It can actually be a sense of ill will. Right? Do we have the right to tell other people whether they should live or not? And in my opinion, no, this should also be a personal decision. This is maybe one of the most personal decisions of all, to make a decision over your own life or not. And so I personally think that, as a matter of principle, people should be allowed to make these decisions, as long as we have some clear safeguards so people don't do it for the wrong reason. They don't feel pressured because they are a burden on society or a burden on the family. That is maybe a bad reason for doing it. But sometimes people really had enough of life, and they have too much pain, and they would rather die. I had an example a few years ago. There was an Englishman who was a disciple, known him for a very long time, and he had one of these terrible neurological illnesses, where you are just gradually declining and declining and declining until you can't do anything more. You're just kind of lying in bed all the time. There's nothing you can do, and you can't, and then you can live like that apparently for quite a while. And he asked me this question: well, when I have this illness, is it okay at some point that I, make this end of life decision? And it's tricky as a monastic, because you can't really say it is okay. You can't encourage people to die, because that is really strongly, strongly against the precepts of a monastic. But what you can do, you can tell in general terms the karmic effect of what you're doing, just as I'm doing now. And so I told them, if you come in from a good place and you know what you're doing, the karma is not going to be bad. Maybe it's even good if you come in from a really good place. And so he ended up going to Switzerland. In Switzerland, they have this thing called the Dignitas Clinic, which is a clinic where they help you with this kind of end of life, basically stop ending your life. And that's where he went, and he ended his life. That was kind of interesting, because it meant that it becomes very real when these things actually happen in this way. And I thought that was quite... it's probably one of those decisions that were very, very well thought out. He had been thinking about it for years and years beforehand. And he was a very nice person, and obviously wasn't depressed or anything like that. He made that decision because basically life becomes meaningless at a certain point. All right. Two more questions. Dear Ajahn, can you briefly explain the monastic life from acceptance into a monastery through to Ajahn and beyond? Also, what happens to one's worldly goods when one becomes a monastic? So basically, the monastic life is, there isn't much difference whether you are a young monk or a senior monk or whatever. That life is basically the same. It's a little bit different how you interact with the world. After a while you do more teachings, obviously, but the life is largely the same. And so you come to the monastery and you enjoy the monastic life, and you decide to ordain, and then that's what you carry on, and you stay like that. Ajahn just means teacher. It's a word from Pali language, acharya, and ajahn is just a Thai version of saying acharya. And that's really all ashin in Burmese, and ajahn in Thai, and etc., etc. So that doesn't really mean very much. So the most important thing with monastic life is how you develop as an individual, whether your mind develops, or whether your meditation develops. That is the critical thing, and that is what matters. And as long as you are developing one way or another, or I should say not one way or another, in the right way, then you are very likely to carry on, because you are fulfilling the purpose of monastic life. So that is the only thing that matters. Are you evolving? Are you developing in the right way? That is the critical issue in monastic life. What happens to your worldly goods? Your worldly goods, well, they initially, it is good to keep those worldly goods for a while, because it is quite common to, if you're going to disrobe, usually disrobing happens usually mostly during the early years, so that you have something that you can go back to if you end up disrobing as a monastic. Yeah, so you keep it for a while, and then there comes a point probably in your life when you want to give it up. Sometimes you can give it up to family members. That's what I did. I gave it to my parents and said, okay, in case I disrobe, here is my things. Please look after it. And I said to my parents, actually, now you can probably give it all away, because I don't think I'm going to disrobe. And then my parents didn't give it away. They kept it because they were hoping that I would disrobe at a certain point. It's very cute, isn't it? This is kind of what parents are like. But anyway, so you want to kind of have that as a kind of safety, yeah, at the back there, so in case things don't turn out the right way. So it's actually quite pragmatic how we do things, so we don't make it impossible to become a monastic. All right, last question for this evening. Dear Ajahn, thank you for making the suttas accessible to us and making them come alive. I am starting to get a glimpse of the bigger picture. Excellent. My questions: if you eat meat, are you breaking the precept of do not kill, harm animals, even if you are not involved in the direct killing of the animal? You are not breaking the precept. And this is quite well known. At the time of the Buddha, they would eat meat, yeah, because one of the things about being a monastic is that you have to accept whatever is given to you. And even for a layperson, it is not the same. Buying meat or eating meat is not the same as killing, because it's just a different feeling. If you kill, that intention to kill, that mental state that you have is quite a different state from buying meat. You can notice this. I don't know if you have killed an insect or if you kill an animal. I remember when I was a teenager or something, I once shot a bird. I had an air gun and I shot a bird, and it was just incredibly, I was just messing around, and I thought, I didn't really think I would kill this bird. I was just kind of, and it was a friend there, and I guess just doing silly things. And I shot and I hit the bird, and it was this incredibly painful feeling to hit another animal. And I realized that intention you have when you shoot something, and that kind of idea, actually that is a very powerful intention, and it actually affects the mind in a very powerful way. Whereas buying meat in the shop does not affect the mind anywhere near in the same way as actually killing something. And so I understood why killing is actually very different from eating meat or buying meat. On the other hand, I think also it is a very nice thing to do to be a vegetarian. Of those people who want to be vegetarians or vegans or whatever, I think it is a very positive thing as well. And if you want to be a vegetarian, I think that's wonderful. There are many, many good reasons for being vegetarian in this world. So I'm certainly not going to underestimate that. Still, there is a difference between eating meat or buying meat and actually killing. And there's something that affects your person far more if you deliberately kill something. Okay, everyone, that is all for tonight. So once again, I wish you a nice rest and a good night's sleep. And then we'll see you again tomorrow morning. Let's just pay respect to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha.